Would you say that in these meetings here, the main thing is the words or something going underneath? Thank you.
I would say there's something underneath.
Yeah.
But don't forget what we were talking about before, T, about the unknowableness of almost everything. So it's just an intuition.
Yeah.
Has no more value than any other intuition. But, I, you know, the words are kind of an excuse to be together, really. If you grant that the real reason for being here is the tea and biscuits, and then you take that out of the equation and you say, well, what's left? The words are kind of an excuse, really, aren't they? So what is it we're talking about? Well, we can only use vague words. We can talk about resonance. It's a word I love. Please don't ask me what it means. We could talk about energy. Again, a word I love. Please don't ask me what it means. You know, we could say it's something that we kind of intuit. There's something intuitive about the energy and the resonance. Intuition is another word I love, but don't ask me what it means. So, something's going on, or it isn't. What an intelligent thing to say. If something's going on, what is it? It's unknowable. And if nothing's going on, well, maybe nothing going on is more powerful than something going on. So if nothing's going on, what is it and what's its power? It's unknowable. You know, it's what I said about the mystic. The main thing, two things the mystic knows. There's unconditional love, and almost everything else is unknowable.
Oh, you changed that. You said something different before.
Did I?
Yeah, you said one thing is that he knows there's no self, and the other thing is the second one.
Well, okay.
Now you said the unconditional.
Yeah, well, they go together. They're kind of identical, really. They go together because in the, I'm going to use the word absolute. In the absolute, seeing that there is no self, which is sometimes called liberation, which doesn't even exist. There is the seeing. The reason that is absolute is because there's the seeing of unconditional love. That's what brings the final full stop to the energy of the person. seeing emptiness is sometimes described as awakening, and seeing emptiness can be a huge shock. It can reconfigure the person in enormous numbers of ways. It can blow all our belief systems and all our stories and all our concepts out of the water, but it doesn't bring an end to the energy of the person. The person still kind of goes on, that energy still runs on. What brings them into it is seeing unconditional love. The nature of this is unconditional love. So you're right, yes, I did say something else, but in a way it's the same thing. If the person ends, that's seeing unconditional love. Seeing unconditional love can't happen unless the person isn't there. Thank you for catching me out. I've forgotten what we were talking about. What were we talking about?
About the something going on beyond the, or under,
yeah,
the word.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. So I could make an absolute statement. We all sense that, which is either true or not true. I don't know if it's true. I could say it. I have no idea if it's true. But it's certainly sensed by some of the apparent individuals in a space like this. What does it consist of? It's unknowable. So we might as well give that unknowability the word energy or resonance or whatever we like. There's something different about being here to reading about this in a book to watching something like this on YouTube. Most of us recognize that. Something different.
How is it that so many people who apparently attain liberation go on having an agenda, teaching and promising a way to develop and so on?
Yeah. Well, again, it's unknowable. we can make guesses. Yeah.
In my feeling, I think if you arrive at it, if it happened to you, you don't have a need to go on teaching. It seems to be compatible.
Yeah. Well, it may not be the same reason in every case. There may be a variety of reasons. All we can do is hypothesize. I certainly am not the only person to have noticed and commented that often, when this is seen, if the individual does start talking about it, they often start talking from a very pure place. And I don't mean pure as in very moral. I mean pure as in a very clear communication that this is it, sort of thing that's been said here. And quite often, if you go back a year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years later, what you've got is somebody teaching instead. I mean, that is quite common. I mean, I'm certainly not the only person to have noticed that. Why is there? Well, there may be a variety of reasons. I mean, one is that the rawness, the absolute kind of rawness of this communication isn't particularly attractive. Mm-hmm. Most of us feeling that we are a person stuck in a dilemma and maybe feeling that we are on a path going somewhere rather than on a hamster wheel going nowhere, it's quite natural for us to want help, to want a teaching, to want to be told what to do. And so you could say, well, it's equally natural for the one who sits in the chair at the front to start going in that direction.
But it is leaving the...
It is, indeed, yeah. So I don't know, I mean...
Going away from the unity.
It's absolutely going away from a kind of clear message. Not that that matters. Of course it doesn't matter. I mean, I could say, well, it's quite misleading to start offering a teaching about this, it's quite misleading. But there's nothing wrong with being misleading. I mean, you know, if we think that being misleading is worse than not being misleading, well, we're just caught in a concept, aren't we? We're just caught in a story in the head again. You know, it's no better or worse to be misguided than to be guided. I mean, one of the things I often say, in my long life of following teachers, I have followed two teachers who I would absolutely say that in quite a large measure were charlatans. I got an enormous amount from them. In fact, in some, you know, I usually say, you know, it's far, you probably learn far more from a charlatan than from a saint. And if nothing else, they were great fun to be with. Whether I learned anything from them or not, I had a lot of enjoyment from being with them. But we make this kind of assumption that somehow it's bad to be a charlatan, it's good to be a saint. Why? Rubbish.
And
who can choose anyway, and who decides? And somebody walks into a room and somebody is saying something completely misleading, and that completely misleading thing may be the very thing that lights the fuse and they disappear.
And it's perfect anyway.
So we you know, using these words like misleading and so forth, I mean, you know, they're not criticisms. The honest answer to your question is I suspect there are kind of different things going on. I mean, I know of one person who gives talks on this, who says, I make compromises. Well, I don't know why he makes compromises. He didn't explain that, but, you know, that's what he said. I make compromises. Maybe there's some belief there that it then makes it more accessible to more people, and that therefore more people might come, and then some of those might experience a dropping away, as if that mattered. I mean, I don't know, we could... How about tomorrow we have non-duality meetings with strawberry trifles? If we advertise that, we probably have more people coming. And maybe some of the people that only came for the strawberry trifle might then drop away. You know, I mean, we could go on with this endlessly. But I think if there is something, you could, I mean, teacher student, guru chela, guru devotee, you know, a Buddhist teacher and Buddhist student, whatever. I mean, it's a kind of dance, right? Mm-hmm. And if there's something in the personality, if there's something in the personality that wants to teach and teaches, that will be attractive to those who have something in their personality who are students or devotees and want to study or be devoted. You know, so it's a kind of perfect dance. You know, the one who seeks for somebody, the one who seeks, let's say, for a guru figure, which is a bit more extreme than a teacher, the one who seeks for a guru figure to feel devoted to, maybe. I mean, devotion is a lovely thing sometimes. Sometimes, as long as it doesn't lead to you emptying your bank account unwisely. So the one who seeks a guru figure, who wants to be devoted, who feels that somehow this is a path to perfection or whatever, is kind of magnetically drawn to their opposite. The one who wants to be a guru figure, who wants devotion, who accepts devotion, maybe they don't even want it, but they accept it. You know, who offers a teaching, who says, be with me and your chakras will open. It's a kind of cosmic dance.
But liberation is to leave this cosmic dance, I think. It is to transcend this dance.
If liberation is seen, it's probable that that particular cosmic dance will lose its attraction, yeah.
Yes, but it's not happening.
It's not happening in some cases, because all sorts of other things, all sorts of other, if you like, forces are at work. You know, like, you know, this personality here, you know, wants to be devoted, so it looks for an object of devotion. That object of devotion might be inanimate, it might be a beautiful golden Buddha statue, but it might be a living a living being, in which case it's going to be a living being who accepts that energy. Yes. So it's a kind of, and again, this sounds like a negative word, it doesn't have to be seen as, it's a collusion. It's a collusion between the guru and the devotee, the teacher and the student. Now in the wise teachings, I mean, there are wise teachings, they tend to be in the kind of more, the less colourful, the less ornamented traditions, but you get very wise teachings in philosophical Taoism, not in religious, I mean religious Taoism is just superstitious nonsense, but in philosophical Taoism, in Zen, in Dzogchen, you know, in these very, usually in these rather stark presentations, you know, you get a lot of wisdom and, you know, you get a lot of hints at least, if not outright slaps round the face, you know, being here will not do you any good. You're welcome to be here, it's lovely, let's all go into the forest and do an 8-day Zen retreat, but just remember, you know, just remember, it's not going to do you any good. This may happen or that may happen. Mm-hmm. And if you went and ate strawberry trifle for a week instead, this may happen or that may happen. I mean, all the wise teachings, remember that.
Well, my feeling is that for this, it's completely irrelevant if this form is liberated or not.
Yeah.
It's equal.
Absolutely. Yeah, but it doesn't feel equal usually to the one who feels himself to be in prison. The one who feels himself to be in prison.
That is the prison.
That's the prison is feeling that I exist in the prison. That is the prison, but it doesn't feel like that for the one in the prison. The one in the prison wants a way to pick the lock. Or they want somebody, maybe a guru figure, to come along and turn the key. Mm-hmm. So absolutely, of course you're right. Of course it makes no difference. I mean, apart from anything else, we're talking about a kind of illusion. And I know that I have used this phrase I don't know how many times since last night when we began, but of course there is no such thing as awakening. There is no such thing as liberation. Or we could equally say, put it the other way around, we could say there is no such thing as non-liberation. Everything is liberation. Liberation includes and embraces everything, including the very powerful feeling that I am not liberated. But you try saying that to the person who feels that they are not liberated and who believes that there is some blessed state that they can attain.
It's like change of perspective.
Yeah, totally.
If this center perspective is in the center, it's a different feeling or perspective or imprisoned feeling than a perspective of this, where this just arises in.
Yeah, and whether this arises as the feeling of liberation, or whether this arises as the feeling of not liberation.
Or murder, or whatever.
Go on. I thought something more dramatic was going to come after the old murder. Well, what happens, happens, and I've noticed that does sometimes include murder. Oh, by the way, I didn't mean personally for me there. It's part of the joke, you know, this thing that sometimes there is a lot of laughter around this, that also is part of the joke, that something into which, if I was a spiritual seeker, something into which I poured so much energy, so much money, so much time, so much devotion, is ultimately seen, firstly, to be so simple, and secondly, not even to be real. It's not even real.
It's a tragic joke.
Yeah, it's a tragic comedy. Yeah. And sometimes we see the tragedy and sometimes we see the comedy. Yeah.
It's more tragic if you go back in the narrow perspective.
Yeah, then it seems very, it can seem very tragic indeed, yeah.
And then the seeking is even stronger because it's like you tasted honey or something.
Oh.
And you want it back, you want to...
Oh, well now, I don't know whether this is touching on something we were talking about in the coffee break. And let me just say a bit about this, and it might be completely irrelevant to what you just said or not, I don't know, right? It seems to me, I talk to a lot of people about this, I get emails, I get phone calls, I kind of put myself out there, I've got a website with a phone number, so people ring me up and so forth. And quite often I'm talking to somebody who might sound quite perplexed about what's happening, right? And it sounds to me, from what they're saying, I can't be sure, but it sounds to me from what they're saying that everything there is to be seen has been seen. There isn't anything more to see. But there is an idea, a very powerful idea hanging on, that if this is it, if this has been seen, it should be better than this. And that can be the kind of last trap for the mind. So I talk to individuals where I feel like, sit down, relax, have a cup of tea, eat a piece of cake. There is absolutely nothing more to be seen than what the individual is reporting, but something is still running in the mind, some thought is still running in the mind, and it could be in numerous different thoughts, but usually it's some version of, well, if this is it, it isn't good enough. If this is it, it should be better than this. Well, whoever said, if this is seen, it's going to be wonderful? Well, if anybody did say that, then ignore them. I mean, this is seen, it's seen there is no person, it's seen that there's this, it's seen that there is unconditional love, and then life goes on. And sometimes, not always, but sometimes I might talk to someone like that and it's like a kind of, light comes on and there's a kind of, oh yeah, and it's like that last thought sort of then drops away.
When it's seen that there's no person, it's like this change of perspective I try to describe.
Yeah.
Like a knowing or seeing or feeling of this which cannot be seen or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And that's such a good feeling.
Yeah.
That this subtle watcher, which is still somewhere, tries to cross it.
Yeah.
And then, since then, it's like a wide, narrow,
Well, that's okay.
Important, not important.
Yeah.
And to have felt the difference makes it even harder to accept that there's nothing, or there's nobody who can do anything about it.
So there's maybe just that idea clinging on, that energy clinging on. I mean, there isn't really a subtle watcher, by the way. There isn't really a subtle watcher, which now has to disappear. That again is a thought, a sensation, We split ourselves up into so many ways, and we are split up into so many ways simply by our kind of social roles and things like that. And then if we're spiritually inclined, then we may split ourselves up into even more ways, one of which might be the subtle watcher or the observer. I mean, there's an awful lot of techniques around, developing the watcher, developing the observer. It's just another crap idea. You're developing something that doesn't exist. It's just a thought, or a sensation, if you like. It's quite an appealing idea to some people because it provides a certain protection against suffering. Because it provides a kind of detachment sometimes. I'm not saying in every case, but in some cases certainly. I've met some really extreme cases of this. They're usually men, by the way. Where, there's been a kind of a real sort of going into this role. I'm calling it a crap idea. You could call it a role, a sort of spiritual role, and a crap spiritual role at that, where, the person, generally a man, has put a lot of energy into developing the watcher, in other words, you know, sort of putting a lot of energy into that thought or that belief. And it provides some protection against suffering. I mean, how? Well, because it can create detachment. And so it can provide protection against suffering. Very often the person actually then follows this through with activity, so they withdraw from activity, so they do less and less activity. Well, I don't know if you've noticed, but activity sometimes involves suffering. So there is a kind of appeal to this, you know, this detached observer watching kind of role. The problem is there's a very high price to be paid for it. And the high price to be paid for it is in terms of vitality. In other words, to whatever extent I cut myself off into an observer role, I also kind of destroy vitality to a certain extent. But none of that actually exists. You know, there isn't really an observer, or, you know, that's...
Yeah, and the joke is nobody creates crap ideas happening.
Yeah, crap so ideas arise. I've noticed that, yeah.
Nobody can choose to have a crap idea.
Yeah, yeah.
Or to seek or not.
Yeah. Yeah. And yet there are these kind of patterns, and one of the patterns that I'm not the only person to notice is that particular crap idea that arises tends to arise more in the psyche of men than in the psyche of women. Not invariably, but it does. You know, there seems to be something about the male psyche which is kind of drawn more towards protecting itself through detachment. None of which matters. But as I put it some time ago in terms of the observer, you know, we don't have to stand 2 foot behind ourselves to discover that we're not a person.
You were using this word of unconditional love.
Yes.
Because if the real awakening kind of happens.
Yes.
But this is still another subject to be seen.
No.
If the unconditional love is experienced,
again,
something happens.
No.
Happening in front of
us. Oh, God, language just so breaks down here. I mean, it may well sound like that, I agree, but no, that's not the case. All I can say is that when the sense of self, that concentrated sense of being a person, you know, when it really kind of falls away, what's seen is, you know, this is nothing, this is nothing, they are the same, they're empty and full. They're empty and full. What is that fullness? It's unconditional love. So it has been said, I wish this was original to me because I love it so much, but Mr. Siddhartha got there first. Seeing I am nothing is wisdom. Seeing I am everything is love. Now, awakening, it doesn't have to be like this. I mean, there certainly doesn't have to be these two apparent events, but sometimes it's like this. There's awakening in which it's seen that I am nothing and this is empty.
Yeah.
That can seem very, very attractive, but there's a kind of coldness about it. And Nisargadatta describes that as wisdom. Seeing the nothing is wisdom. Seeing I am nothing is wisdom. How can we say this? Well, in a kind of negative way, in the sense that up to that point, it's probable that this head will be full of some really stupid ideas. Really, really stupid ideas, like, I don't know, I have to make God pleased with me by whipping myself if I'm a member of Opus Dei, for example. I mean, there's an example of a really crap idea. I won't bother to list any more, but I mean, just one more. I need to pay the Diksha people in India 5,000 euros every 3 months so that I can become enlightened. I mean, there is a really crap idea, and a very expensive one as well. So, in the seeing of emptiness, all of that collapses. Right? So you could say that, let me put it this way, you could say that there's a kind of natural wisdom which is interfered with by all the crap ideas we pick up as we go along this apparent path of being a person. And in the, even in a split second of seeing emptiness, all of those crap ideas can fall away. And so suddenly there's just the natural wisdom. And what the natural wisdom says really is, I don't know anything. I mean, that's the natural wisdom. Nothing can be known.
Okay, but how do you make the... But what's the difference between this natural wisdom and the state you call seeing everything...
Right.
It's love. So it must be something different.
Yeah, there is. So if we talk about... If we talk about stages or phases, which is ridiculous, yeah. But nevertheless, just for the sake of this, this is what... Nisargadatta is talking about. He's talking about awakening. In awakening, it's seeing that I am nothing, this is nothing, this is empty, and that brings wisdom in the sense that it brings the death of a lot of rubbish ideas and stories, right? In what we will call, for the purposes of explanation and for no other purpose, liberation, what tends to bring an end to the trajectory of the person, you see, that seeing of nothing, the person tends to come back afterwards, often in quite a state of shock, and then the person is running, often in quite a state of despair as well after that. What brings an end to that energy of the person is the seeing that this is not only empty, it's also full. Now, I can't it's impossible to describe this. We're not even talking about an experience. All I can see is that when it's seen, it's seen. There's no arguing with it. When it's seen, it's absolutely like, wow. So we could talk about the person disappearing, seeing that there is absolutely no one here, that there is only this. This is empty, completely empty, and completely full. It's also completely full. What's it completely full of? Unconditional love. Its nature is unconditional love. That's what seems to bring an end to the energy of the person. So that's what Nisargadatta is saying. See, seeing I am nothing is wisdom. Seeing I am everything is love.
Can one be stuck in this state of quite wisdom,
more... Absolutely, of course. Yeah, anything can happen. Often, but not always, that momentary seeing that I am nothing, that kind of astonishing increase in wisdom simply through the disappearance of a lot of superstitious stories, can be followed by despair. It doesn't have to be, but it can be. And then that can... In the story of time, that can go on for a long time. Or not. Yeah, because again, there aren't any rules. And there doesn't have to be these two distinct scenes either. It certainly doesn't have to be. It's just that that happens often enough to make it worth commenting on. So, in a way, I mean, the power of that scene, the power of seeing unconditional love, I mean, it's incredibly powerful. If you think about it, for the average, reasonably intelligent human being, that statement, it's all unconditional love, conflicts with personal experience to a remarkably high extent. There is a huge apparent conflict between the statement, everything is unconditional love, and the average experience of the average reasonably well-educated, reasonably alert adult. And yet that experience is so powerful, so overwhelming, that I would suggest that it just destroys or makes irrelevant all of the objections that the intelligent adult mind can make to it. Because to an intelligent adult mind, it's a preposterous thing to say. Absolutely preposterous. How can you justify saying that? Well, I wouldn't even try to justify it. I mean, I'm a reasonably well-educated, reasonably intelligent person. I wouldn't try and justify it. All I can do is say it's the case. Now, that sounds pretty pathetic, doesn't it? On the level of argument, that sounds pretty pathetic. But then, as I say, if you have an argument between the mind and oneness, the mind will always win. It doesn't make any difference. Well, it's an outrageous thing to say. To many adult, intelligent, well-educated minds, to say it's unconditional love, this is filled with unconditional love, it's an outrageous thing to say, because the mind will say, well, excuse me, it certainly doesn't look like that. Well, I agree. It certainly doesn't look like that. What can I say to justify this outrageous statement? Nothing. I can't say anything to justify it. I could just sit here and say, well, as a matter of fact, it is the case. And it's seeing that that kills off the person. And none of that matters. I mean, it's seen or it's not seen. We're back to that maybe rather frustrating statement. It's seen or it's not seen. It doesn't matter which.
Doesn't that lead for some persons directly in the psychiatry sometimes?
Does what lead them?
This awakening, this radical...
Yeah, it's possible. Well, anything's possible. One of the things that is not uncommon, I mean, it's not hugely common, it's not common enough to get too anxious about it, but certainly one of the things that you could say is that the initial stages of psychosis are often very similar to or identical to the initial stages of awakening. And I don't know about in Germany, but in England there's an organisation, very good organisation, of mental health workers. It's an organisation of mental health workers, psychiatrists and people who've had been in the psychiatric system as patients, specifically around this and specifically to help individuals who feel that they are somehow maybe caught between these two things and don't know which. Is this psychosis or is it awakening? Because they can definitely be confused. I've met some of the people in it. It's a very good organisation. I mean, sometimes I get emails or phone calls from people who are kind of in an anxious state about this, and I always give them the name of this organisation. But yes, absolutely, they can be confused. Yeah. Or intertwined. I mean, they can be confused, or they can be bound up with each other. There can be what could be going on, maybe part awakening and part psychosis.
Yeah.
It's not that common, though. I mean, it's common enough to be commented on, but it's not that common. Yeah. I suspect what is more common, although I'm not sure, is that where awakening happens, there can be anxiety and fear amongst friends and family that it is psychosis. So friends and family can get very worried because it can bring about such a kind of sudden change or transformation in the person, in what they express and where their motivation is and where their energy is, that it's not surprising if occasionally a loving wife or a loving parent might tiptoe out into the hallway and start ringing the psychiatrist. So, I don't give advice, this isn't really advice, but sometimes I do suggest to people that it's probably quite a good idea not to say very much about this to certain people in their lives.
May I ask you a personal question?
Well, you can ask me. I don't know how I'll answer it.
Are you married?
I am not married. I am divorced. Yes. out.
Because I heard from different, I mean, Tony Parsons is married and...
I know Claire very well, yeah.
Yeah, and I imagine it's quite difficult between a marriage or a relationship between somebody who maybe had an awakening or whatever liberation and somebody who has no, or is not even interested in.
Mm. Well, it may be. There may be difficulties. Who knows? But I think that certainly where difficulties do tend to arise, and I've had a lot of cases like this talk to me. I mean, I'm not sure if this is the worst scenario or not, but it's a pretty bad scenario, is where you have a couple who have been jointly devoted to a spiritual path. So let's say, for example, they have both for 30 years followed the guru. Right, and they have given the guru 20% of their income every year. They go to India twice a year. They run a little meditation center in their house every week. They have a discussion every week program. You know where you see where this is going. You know, they sell DVDs of, you know, all of their social life is around other people who are around the guru and so on. I mean, I know lots of people like this. You know, everybody else has fallen away. You know, they don't go to a sinner anymore, not even to see avant-garde French movies, they don't go to concerts, their whole energy together is bound up with devotion to the guru. Now there are some couples who are kept together, their marriages are kept together, maybe very successfully for decades, by a dog, aren't there? I mean, there are some couples who basically, if the dog dies, that's it, they're going to split up. I know a couple, and they had, their dog was getting very, very old about 3 years ago, and believe me, they were in a rush. They went out and they got a new puppy before the old dog died. You know, and if you knew anything about this couple, you could see absolutely what that was about. If that dog had died before the new puppy arrived, that couple was going to get divorced. So, you know, a dog, a simple dog can hold a couple together. Well, think how much stronger is the glue of devotion to our guru. The devotion is the same, all our activity is geared towards this. And so, well, now imagine that one day a catastrophe strikes, an absolute catastrophe. It may just be a split second of awakening for one of those two, and they can't take any of that seriously anymore. They've seen through it in a split second. You can imagine the challenge that that can then present to the relationship. You know, suddenly one of these two people has no interest anymore in going to India, in running the meditation course, in selling the DVDs. You know, they don't want to. They no longer want to, you know, hang out with the other devotees in satsang. Now they suddenly start taking an interest in avant-garde French cinema instead. And to the other one, it just seems appalling. Because the other one knows that they're on such a meaningful spiritual path. So this can be an absolute catastrophe. It doesn't have to be, but it can be. It can be worse than a dog dying.
It would be a good cinema.
Hmm?
It would be a good film. It would
be a good film, yeah. Yeah, but there are no rules, so I'm sure there are relationships in which, you know, one person may be passionate about this and the other person has no interest in it whatsoever. That's probably a great deal easier than if you've both been following Muktananda for 30 years and then one of you suddenly decides that that's a complete, you know, completely trivial. And it's tea time.
Again.
Again, yeah.